This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen. I hope everything is good and grand inside of your neck of the woods as we are hanging out on this Tuesday, May the 20th of 2025. So let's do some backtracking right away as we're starting off because we need to talk about this. Today's show is going to consist of a conversation that took place when I was down in good old Banff, Canada, talking about everything that was going on inside of the world of Energy Safety Canada's conference. But what we're going to do is at the very beginning, we're going to start off with a keynote by Sean Brady. The name of the keynote is What We Can Learn from Fatalities in the Mining Industry. That's how we're going to start. If you're familiar with Sean, is because we had Sean on here last year and he talked about some incident that occurred with a Boeing. And today, well, he's going to talk about some mining stuff. Just for some background, Sean is a forensic engineer who investigates engineering failures from a technical and organizational perspective. In 2020, he completed the Brady Review, an investigation into the causes of a fatality that occurred in Queensland. So if you're ready for this, we're going to go into the keynote first. And then at the end of the keynote, we're going to have a follow-up conversation with Sean Brady here on Safety FM with Jay Allen.
In safety, in my opinion, you woke up. You saw the system, the simulation, the structure that trained you to mistake compliance for care. Safety mutation. Information misdirection picks up where the signal fractured. Because the system didn't shut you down, it rebranded you. It packaged your voice. Sold your rebellion as a new initiative. And smiled while doing it. This isn't a manual. It's a decoded transmission about what happens when slogans replace stories, when safety becomes marketing, and when truth gets mirrored so perfectly, you forget it was ever yours. You'll see the mutation. Learning teams turned into theater. Zero harm turned into optics. And feedback turned into formatting. But the signal didn't die. It was redirected. Safety Mutation is book two of the Signal Transmission Trilogy. Available now in print, Kindle, and audiobook. Narrated by the author Jay Allen, PhD. Because the system adapted. Now it's your move.
Thank you, Sylvie. And quite correct. I'm not a fighter when it comes to those sorts of things. So we're going to talk about what we can learn from fatalities in the mining industry. I don't think it really matters whether you're in mining, you're in oil and gas, if you're in a high hazard industry. A lot of the findings that we arrived at in this review will apply to the work you do. And you're going to hear a lot of echoes from Steve's presentation in terms of the decisions that were made in Piper Alpha and why things went the way they did. So just to start off with the review, you can Google it, you can find it online, it's free. There's one piece of it, which is Appendix B, which we'll talk about. If you read nothing else in this review, have a read of that, and we'll talk about why in a second. If you're more into listening rather than being a reader, grab your phone and scan that QR code. This is a podcast series, a limited podcast series we put together. We got together after the review came out because the regulator said, fabulous review, Sean. It's a pity nobody's going to read it. So we decided to put together a podcast series. We got industry leaders together. We got the regulator together, which is a very important part of this puzzle. And we got union leaders together. And we interviewed them about where do we go after the review? How do we really deal with the challenges in the mining industry? So let's start with a couple of questions that I want you to think about and ask yourself. Keep the answer on the inside, but try and be as honest with yourself as you can. What do you believe causes fatalities in high hazard industries? When you're thinking about that, ask yourself, what is the role of human error or human violations in fatalities? Answer those two questions for yourself. So let's start with the review. Why did the review happen? Well, the review happened because in a 12-month period in Queensland, we had 6 fatalities in the mining industry. The last 2 fatalities came within a fortnight of each other. And there was a genuine public outcry about why are we killing people in the mining industry in 2019? How can this still be happening? We know all the hazards. How do we not seem to be able to stop people dying? The mining minister at the time pulled in the senior leaders, the CEOs, the COOs, board members into a room and said, what are we going to do differently? They had a safety reset and the minister announced there was going to be a review into understanding what causes fatalities. That review arrived on our desk and we started working on it in July 2019. And we finished it by Christmas of that year, and it was published in the Queensland Parliament in February 2020. Our job was to look at 20 years of fatalities, figure out what causes fatalities, and what the industry and the regulator needs to do differently in order to stop these tragedies happening. So a few quick numbers, which of course are much more than numbers, they're people. 47 people were killed in the Queensland mining industry in that 20-year period. We looked at those 47 fatalities in detail. We also, for context, looked at 35,000 incidents. These are the incidents that are reported to the regulator. These are your lost time injuries, your serious accidents, which are our sort of version of your CIF-A. And we also looked at high potential incidents, which is our version of your CIF-P. There'll be variations in those definitions, but they're pretty much the same thing. And over that period of time, there was 1.6 billion hours worked in the industry. So what do we find? We could spend the whole afternoon talking about what we find, but let's focus on the key things. And let's start not with the fatalities, but with the serious accidents. Now, the serious accidents in Queensland are a reportable injury, and they have a very strict definition. They are accidents or incidents where someone has been killed or someone has been admitted to hospital for the treatment of their injury. In other words, it's serious enough that you have to be admitted to hospital. It's a really important measure because it's a third-party measure. There's a doctor deciding whether the injury is serious or not. Now, when these serious accidents happen in the industry, the mine where the incident happens has to report to the regulator what caused the incident. And there's a number of buckets they can put the answer into. And I've hidden the pie chart. I'm just showing you the legend of the pie chart, but we thought we might have a think about this. Broadly, there's 2 categories the regulator wants details on. One, was the hazard not identified, and therefore there was no control in place? Or was the hazard identified, but there was some sort of an issue with the control? It was bypassed, it was ineffective, etc. Now, we've got to be a little bit careful about this data because it's self-reported from the mine. But anyone got any ideas about which is the main offender there? Bypassed. Interestingly, in the quarrying industry, that was much higher than in underground or open cut mining. Any other takers? Ineffective controls. And there'll be lots of shouting out this afternoon to make it interesting. This is what we found. A mixture of ineffective controls, absolutely. The single biggest category for causes of serious accidents are ineffective controls. What do we mean by ineffective controls? We mean controls that the company believed were there. Controls that were written down in a document somewhere that should exist on site. But when it came to those controls actually being required to function and prevent an accident or an incident, they were ineffective. So ineffective controls is the biggest. But look at how big hazard not identified is, 35%. Now, there are no new hazards in the mining industry. They're all the same as we've already been dealing with, but somehow we seem to be missing them. And if you think about this, this is a failure of risk management 101. You know, it's drummed into us. You identify the hazard, you put a control in place. Identify the hazard, put a control in place. We're failing at both. Now, when these serious accidents occur, over the period of the next few months, the mining company has to report to the regulator what they're doing to prevent reoccurrence of this incident. And they have to, they would report in free text to the regulator what they were going to do to manage this hazard. Remember, this is a hazard with a demonstrated ability to kill you or put you in hospital. And they reported to the regulator as to what they were going to do in plain text. We took all that plain text and we categorized it into, you know, a hierarchy most of you will be very, very familiar with, the hierarchy of controls. And of course, we know what the hierarchy of controls, that the further up we're near the top, the better that control is going to be. Eliminate the hazard, substitute it for something less hazardous, isolate your people from the hazard, use engineering controls. And then we move to administrative controls and PPE. And we can draw a big red line there. And what do we call the hazards or the controls above the line? Collectively. The hard controls. And what do we call the controls below the line? Soft controls. We deal with this all the time in our workplaces, but what's the fundamental difference between a hard control and a soft control? Shout it out.
Money.
It's really interesting. Almost every time I ask this, someone shouts money. And I think that's, you know, that is absolutely right in terms of how people think of these things. But that's not the answer I'm looking for here, but it's not necessarily the wrong answer. Anything else?
Buy-in.
Reliance
on people.
Buy-in. Process. Reliance on people. So the soft control is a reliance on people. When we say we're relying on people to control the hazard, what are we actually saying?
Be careful.
Be careful. We're seeing a sophisticated version of be careful. But even further than that, when we tell someone to be careful, what are we actually telling them about the hazard? It exists. We are saying, as an organization, this hazard, we are not going to touch it. We just need you to be more careful around it. Every time we pick a soft control, and soft controls will always be part of our industry, but when we pick a soft control, we are saying to our workers, we as an organization are choosing to leave the hazard in play. It's up to you to be more careful around it, please. Challenge your companies to get further up that hierarchy of controls so that we actually start to tackle the hazards, not the behavior of the people around them. So here is the results hidden of what companies do after a serious accident has occurred. And you'll see elimination, substitution, all of the rest of them. What do you think is the most common response after a serious accident? And remember, this is the accident that kills you or puts you in hospital for treatment. What do you reckon it is? Administrative controls. It's like a choir when we do this. But there's still something deeply confronting about that graph. This hazard had a demonstrated ability to put you in hospital or kill you. And we're saying to workers that in 62% of the cases, can you please try and be more careful around that? That is a confronting number. And it's actually worse. You'll see some in the legend there. Some of them are still under investigation. Some of them are no action taken. If you actually look at the hard controls, the blue, green, and orange, you're talking about 30% controls are hard controls following an incident. And this is pretty common year on year on year. And this is the highest form of control. So, you know, if we go and we deal with a hazard and we put in an engineering control, like a guard, for example, we will also have an admin control with that hard control about maintenance and all those sorts of things. This is not counting those admin controls. This is where we're saying the highest form of control on the hierarchy that we have put in place to manage this hazard, it is an admin control. That we have to be able to do better. So I would challenge every organization here, go to your controls, particularly if you've got critical controls, and ask and count up how many of them are admin at the highest form of control. You will find a number that is scarily high. You are managing your hazards by expecting your people to be more careful around them. Out of interest and for a little bit of fun, we took all that free text of all the actions, and we put it in a word cloud. The bigger the word, the more often it appears in what's submitted. Does anyone want to take a bet on the word that appears most often? Training. Procedure. Discipline. We've disciplined the workers so hard they won't hurt themselves again. My favorite was held a stern toolbox talk. That's a real control after someone went to hospital. Anything else? We haven't used, I've got some of the words, but my favorite word is missing. Competency.
Safety stand down.
We all love a reset. What do you do when you really don't want to do anything?
Oh, review.
Review. You review what happens. So you'll see review, ensure, and that's always ensure everyone else does something different next time. And procedure, you can see under ensure. So what you see in these controls is not only are they admin controls, but you have to be honest with yourself about how good they actually are. After the conference, get the controls you put in place after an accident or the actions, dump them in a word cloud. You will see what your company does when things go wrong and how that company responds. Very, very confronting thing to put in front of your leaders. And the other thing about review is many people's safety system has actions that need to be closed out, and there's all rules around all that sort of stuff. You can put in an action that is review, and you can close that action out and show that you're ticked the box without the review ever taking place. Most systems don't have that next layer to check whether the action actually produced effectiveness. Are we doing things for compliance or performance? Of course, this sort of thing would never happen in Canada. So we had a look at the potentially serious incidents. So these are different. These are not the actual incidents. They're not the CIF-A's. They're the CIF-P's. Work done by Energy Safety Canada identified the two most common responses for a CIF-P. And remember, a CIF-P tells you so much about where your system almost created an actual, but probably because of good luck, it didn't. It's your most valuable learning information you can get your hands on. How do Canadian companies respond when they have one of these incidents that they could really learn where their system is weak? What's the two things you do?
Review.
Review.
Train.
Ensure. And train and ensure. Train, you get one more. What?
Procedure.
Absolutely. Both completely focused on the individual. Soft controls. We're going to leave the hazard in play. With that, let's move on to the fatalities. And this will get confronting. So this is I'm putting a warning around this in terms of content. Anyone who feels they want to leave the room, we all understand, no problem at all. So we had 47 fatalities. Let's look at just the bare facts on how these people died. And I would ask you, does that look materially different from your industry? Vehicle accidents, machinery, strata failures, falls from height, tire failures, fire, irrespirable atmosphere. The problem when you look at this list is, and the regulator used to release a little two-liner with each of these when these fatalities would occur, is you get this feeling of, that's such a freak accident. How would I ever stop that from coming? How would I ever anticipate that that was even possible? But an interesting thing happens when you actually dig into these fatalities to understand why people died. And one of the problems we had was that when we started the work, the regulator arrived with boxes of nature and cause reports. These are the reports that investigate each of these failures. injuries, fatalities, I should say. They are between 50 and 250 pages long. And the challenge became, how do you condense this information down so you can actually analyze it and that people can actually learn from these fatalities? So what we decided to do was we represented them as causal diagrams. Now, this is certainly not our invention. Most of the inspiration for this was from Andrew Hopkins, who many of you might know, a very famous process safety expert. And this is confronting stuff, but what you do is you represent on a single A4 page how somebody died. I've hidden most of this because we're going to actually go through it. This is full of boxes. You start reading it in the bottom left-hand corner. This is a fatality where a worker was thrown from a bus through the window and the bus rolled over on top and killed the worker. We're going to step through it. Each box is a contributing factor. We've tried to put the box in various categories of physical, individual, supervision, and organizational. There's an element of subjectivity in that process, so we may argue about some of those things. I will draw your attention to one thing. That word says supervision. It doesn't say supervisor. We'll come back to that. Terribly important. So let's work backward. Worker receives fatal injuries after he is thrown from and pinned under the bus. This occurred because the bus rolled over. The bus rolled over because it collided with a safety berm. This is one of those small buses that pick you up at the end of your shift in an open cut mine. The safety berm is that mound of dirt that runs down the side of the road to stop you going off the road. The bus collided with the safety berm because the driver drove over onto the wrong side of the road, hit the safety berm, the bus rolled over, someone is killed. There was no evidence of drugs, alcohol, or any sort of medical issue with the driver. We do not know why the driver drove over onto the other side of the road. But if we stop the investigation right now, what does this look like? Driver's fault. Human error. If only the driver hadn't, you know, drove with the usual skill and care or due skill and care. But how many investigations inside your organization stop right here? The minute we find the human error, we stop. And we say, if that human error hadn't happened, we wouldn't be dealing with a fatality. And if that human error was the result of a violation of some policy, the blame game would begin. But let's go further. Turned out the safety berm wasn't designed according to the standard for the site. The site had their own standard. They defined what that standard was. Safety berm not designed for it. That was never picked up by supervisors, by inspectors. Why? Give me your best guess. No one had ever done it before. In what way?
No one had ever died before.
No one had ever died before. Sorry, I tell you, sit down in front. And no one had ever died before. So, you know, these are inspections that are meant to take place. You can go to the manual, and inside the manual, the company has said these safety berms will be inspected. What do you reckon is the simplest way to miss something in an inspection? Not do the inspection. The safety berms were never inspected. Why were the safety berms never inspected? What's the simplest, most bland, boring reason they were never inspected? Sorry?
They weren't scheduled.
They weren't scheduled? You're on the right track. No time. Think even more mundane than that. It's even worse than pretty much all the suggestions I've picked up. They had no system for checking whether the inspections were actually taking place. Classic. We see this all the time. Admin control says we will check the safety berms. No system to make sure that actually happened. This is the difference between, you know, writing it down and actually doing it. They didn't even get as far as the compliance stage, never mind the effectiveness stage. Let's keep going. Well, hang on, before we do, look at where that sits. We're a long way from the bus driver now. We're right up in the belly of the organization at this point. We're starting to see the sort of decisions being made that Steve talked about earlier. Keep going. Bus rolled over, worker thrown from the bus. One of the reasons the worker was thrown from the bus was the bus had a modified rear design. So this rear design basically made the bus long in the back, and when it tipped, what it did was it projected the victim, who was sitting in the back seat, further and faster than they would in a normal vehicle. And that was enough to fire them out the window. Now, there were risk assessments undertaken back at a procurement stage on the buses, and this risk was never identified. Hold that thought for a second. What was the other reason the worker was thrown from the bus? Didn't have their seatbelt on. It's always interesting how much gusto the crowd have for that bit. And we're going to come back to that idea. The worker wasn't wearing their seatbelt. They should have been wearing their seatbelt. What was the check to make sure the worker had to wear their seatbelt?
There wasn't one.
There wasn't one. There was. It was written down inside the organization. What was it? Rules, bus driver. The bus driver's job before they pulled off was to check everyone was wearing their seatbelt. The bus driver didn't do that. Turns out, and again, written down on paper, what does real life look like? The design of the bus was such that the bus driver couldn't sit there and look around and check all the seatbelts. What they had to do was open the door, take off their own seatbelt, walk out, walk around the back of the bus, look in the side. Yep, everyone's wearing their seatbelt. How many times do you reckon that happened?
The first time.
Probably not many times after. Looks fine on paper, doesn't look fine in real life. Bus driver couldn't actually check from where they were sitting. Now, what's interesting about this check is that back at the procurement stage, the people procuring the bus were offered the opportunity to have optional seatbelt alarms installed. And they chose not to. They apparently believed that the bus driver checking was sufficient. You know, they could have chose a better control, but they felt what they had was okay. And interestingly, the reason for this being missed and the reason for the risk of the hazard of the extended rear design of the bus being missed was there was a risk assessment, but there was no content experts in the risk assessment. There was no one who could say, look, these guys never use their seatbelts. We need the alarms. No one to say, the back of this bus has been fundamentally changed. Has that been checked? Now, I would challenge you. We love risk assessments in the mining and oil and gas industry. We love them. But if you have the wrong people in the room, those risk assessments are not worth the paper they're written on, and worse, they give you a false sense of security. This is a classic example of compliance. We did the risk assessment versus effectiveness. Did it adequately control the hazard? Now take a look at this one pager. There are a lot of boxes on this one pager. And if you go to the report and go to Appendix B and look at all 44 of the fatalities, even if you flick through those pages, you will by and large see a lot of boxes. A lot of things go wrong for someone to get killed. We tend to see multiple control failures. Controls that the organization believed existed on paper, but when required to perform in real life were ineffective. For example, safety berms designed properly, bus still hits it, bus likely to not roll over, just bounce off it, we avoid the fatality. We can go and switch on and off those controls and we avoid the fatality. Fatalities happen because lots of things go wrong. What's really interesting about this slide, if this was a smaller group, at some point someone in the room goes, Jesus, if only he'd wore the bloody seatbelt. And I would suggest many of you feel like that too. I have yet to hear anyone say, geez, if only we designed the safety berm properly. It's interesting, but there's a fundamental difference between blaming the system and blaming the person, and it's much more satisfying to blame the person than to blame the system. But that's what distracts you from fixing the system, and that was what will distract your leaders from fixing the system. And we're going to come back to this plenty of times before we're finished. Lots of things have to go wrong for someone to die. Now, let's pull out some themes that came up again and again in the review. The first one was training. And Steve talked about training as well. Of the 47 fatalities, 17 people had a lack of training. No training, not bad training, no training in the piece of equipment they were using or the part of the mine they were working in. No training. What is the fundamental issue if you've got no training in a piece of equipment or a part of a mine or a part of a facility? What's the, well, let's boil this down. What is the fundamental problem?
You don't know.
You don't know what you don't know. And we can even get more specific. We can say we don't know the hazards and we don't know the controls to protect us from those hazards. And Steve made a great point about competency and training. And we really, really do confuse the two. We train to tick boxes quite often. I say to senior leaders, you should be able to stand outside the door of a room where training is occurring in your organization, specific training. And you should be able to stop a person at random walking out of that room and say to them, I want you to tell me, for the task you've just been trained in, what are the hazards? What are the controls to protect you from those hazards? And how do you know that control is working? But we don't do that. We bury those answers inside 20 pages of other stuff. And we tell people what to do. We don't tell them why they're doing it. We don't tell them you have to do this step because this step is controlling this hazard. And if you skip that step, you are going to be in a world of trouble. Have to move from training to competency. Tackle your training inside your organizations. The second thing is, for a further nine, there was inadequate training. In other words, they'd sat training, but it was pretty bad. They didn't leave with knowledge of the hazards and the controls. Add those two together, you get 26. 26 out of 47 fatalities, training plays a major role. They didn't know or understand the hazards and controls. Without that, we are sending them into battle completely unarmed. And the last major finding, or the second last major finding, is supervision. And again, it's supervision, not supervisor. We estimated that in 32 of the 47 fatalities, some form of supervision was required, and it was deficient in 25 of those 32 situations. This was everything from a supervisor actively watching and not being aware of the hazards in the situation, a supervisor watching knowing someone wasn't trained for the work they were doing, a supervisor who didn't get to the work area and never saw the work area at all, and the work proceeded without them. In Australia, we have a massive supervision problem, largely because we make them sit inside filling in forms for 6 hours of their shift, rather than having them out there working with their people. And it's not about supervisors. Supervision is how many supervisors we have, how well we train them, not only in the hard stuff of here are the hazards, here are the controls, but the soft stuff in how do I stop an overeager crew from doing this work when I know it's unsafe? How do I stop an overeager crew when a production bonus is tied to it? How do I make a member of the crew report an incident where our bonuses depend on us not reporting it? How do I handle all of that? We have a massive supervision problem in Australia that's going to be a big job to tackle. And the last one, we didn't even put a number on this. Oh, actually, before we go there, one other point in supervision that I think is really important. we didn't have the data, but in Western Australia, there was a study done in 2014, and they collected this data. In their fatality data, they were able to identify that 44%, so 44% of fatalities occur under the supervision of a supervisor who's in their first year on the job. If that stat doesn't compel you to take a look at how you deal with supervision in your company, I really don't know what will. Supervision is really your last line of defense. If the supervisor won't stop the work, who will? And the last one, as I said, is ineffective controls. We didn't count these because they were everywhere, absolutely everywhere. Controls the organization believed were in place, but failed to work effectively on the day. And there was work, some work done by the ICMM, the International Council of Minerals and Mining, a few years after this review came out. From their data, they have concluded that 86% of mining fatalities worldwide occurred because of ineffective controls. Controls that the organization believed were there and on paper, but didn't work at the time. That's a massive percentage. I quite cheekily say it's not hazards that kill people, it's ineffective controls. And if you take one takeaway from this presentation, this is what I would like you to take away. It's not hazards that kill people, it's ineffective controls. We need to shift our focus from hazards to controls and control effectiveness. And we have to have our whole organization focused on that. Now, one of the recommendations I made in the report was that organizations should adopt the principles of high reliability organizations. We're going to talk about these for a minute. This is one of these recommendations that seemed really sensible, and when the report went out, all hell broke loose. Everyone said, great, where do I buy the pack, the word pack, to apply this in my organization? And as we're going to talk about, you can't do that. High reliability organizations is about a way of thinking about your existing practices. It's a way of thinking about how you work currently. Now, what are high reliability organizations? They are organizations that work in incredibly hazardous industries, yet have very few incidents. One of those industries we're very familiar with. Anyone want to shout out what it is? Airline, nuclear is another one, absolutely. Airline is probably the most common one we all think. If you think about taking a flight, we're climbing into a metal tube with 200 other people, and we're going to fly up in the sky. If that wasn't mad enough, when we get up there, there's going to be thousands of other planes up there too. We have got incredibly safe at flying. When, you know, it's very rare we hear of mid-air collisions anymore. Most of us are more worried about sketchy Air Canada Wi-Fi than we are about not getting home. We have made it so safe. Now the question is, how do they do it? And they've been around for 40 years, high reliability organizations. How do they do it? Well, we're going to come up with some familiar topics, but the key thing I want you to think about it is, do they do it by doing what we all do, only better? Or do they do it because they do something quite different? Now, to understand what they do quite different, we need to talk about a concept that I think is really helpful in getting your head around this stuff. And that's this concept of drift into failure that you've probably heard about before. But let's step through what drift into failure is. So we want to get something out of the ground usually. And we tend to work in industries with a lot of people involved. And although we're digging in the ground and doing hazardous things, what do we tell everyone? What is the most important thing to us as an organization? You're very quiet on this one. Your managers will be very disturbed. You don't shout this out immediately. What is the first priority in every single organization? Safety first, absolutely. We're going to be safe. We're going to be safe. And how do we do it? Well, I would suggest most organizations in this room do it by putting some sort of safety system in place. And what we mean by putting some sort of safety system in place, we'll put policies and procedures and we'll train everyone to follow those policies and procedures, and we'll send them out to do the work. And as long as they just bloody well follow the procedures, no one will get hurt. And if someone does get hurt, it's probably because someone didn't follow the procedure. We need to find that person and make an example of them. That's how we traditionally work. It's a compliance-based approach to managing safety. A compliance-based approach is much better than having no compliance at all. It's much better. It's much, much safer. But let's look at how it plays out in practice in our organizations. So we're going to put procedure and systems in place. And boy, do we love this. You know, we don't just do one, we just keep going. And we layer them up. And this is going to keep people safe. And this assumption is so powerful. Everyone feels at senior levels in companies that if we can just get people to follow this, comply with it, they will be safe. That's an implicit assumption. But of course, what happens is the guys or girls go out and very quickly they go, oh no, this procedure doesn't really work. And there are so many reasons why the procedure doesn't really work. Quite often, it's written by someone in the legal department to meet some external requirement. Even if we do better than that, it could be written by the technical experts, but not necessarily by the people who actually do the work. It's actually quite hard to get a set of procedures for people who actually do the work. And even apart from that, we get into situations, the procedure may say you use this particular piece of equipment. Unfortunately, no one told procurement that. So you're left with something different. There are so many reasons why our procedures don't work. What happens when a procedure doesn't work? Do the miners leave the site, come to head office and says, we need to rewrite this procedure? No, we do a workaround. Why did we do a workaround? Multiple reasons. One, we usually pay them to do a workaround. But we call it a production bonus. We pay them to get on with the job. We reward them to get on with the job. And what workers typically do, very rarely do workers set out to sabotage or meaningfully do harm. What they usually do is they go, well, if I make a little deviation from the procedure, that'll solve my problem. And let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Many of them will even do what we'd call a local risk assessment, where they'll have a look at it and they say, no, I think that's going to work. And they do it, and it works, and nothing bad happens. So what happens? They do it again. And it's a weird thing with us humans. The more time we do something that we were initially a little bit worried about, and nothing bad happens, we start to take that as proof that nothing bad will ever happen. And we give ourselves the seal of approval, and that gets embedded in the crew, and that's simply how the work is done. We don't have a procedure over here, no problem. We can solve that pretty speedy, but a workaround and adaptation as well. We got a hazard here. Hazard is really interesting. Hazard tells us immediately there's a problem with the system. The system that we were given to implement hasn't covered all the hazards. But when you talk to frontline workers, what do frontline workers usually do when they find a hazard? Anyone like to shout it out? They fix it, yeah, they deal with it. And then you say, did you report it? And they go, no, why would I? I fixed it. And of course, the problem is that hazard can be lurking here and it can be lurking here, but those work groups may not have had the competency to pick it up the way the first group did. So we have senior people in our organization who believe work is happening like this, but in reality, it's happening like this. And we can talk about lots of different words, work as imagined, work as done. We can talk about black line, blue line, which is absolutely right. But fundamentally, what we end up with in our organizations is a disconnect between how we think the work is done and how it's actually been done. And then a really funny thing happens. We think work's happening like this. It's actually happening like this. But because everyone smoothed out the rough corners on the procedures, we actually speed up. And because we speed up, we produce more. And because we produce more, management get really, really happy. And because management get really, really happy, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. And usually that aligns with our KPIs. And this is called outcome bias. We conclude when we see an outcome we like that the underlying basis that provided that outcome is in and of itself sound as well. Very, very common. And this is the beginning of drift into failure. We start tweaking our system. We start adapting our system because we essentially have to get the work done. And it's not just happening in one place, it's happening everywhere. And it happens and grows over time. Because with each little adaptation that we make and discover, it speeds us up and nothing bad happens. we tweak it again and again and again. What started off here, one step at a time, we move across until suddenly an accident happens. And somebody goes, my goodness, why are you doing this? That's so different than this. And you go, well, we didn't just go from there to there. Over a year, we went all these little steps, which in and of themselves, individually, looked quite reasonable and sensible. And drift, this is drift, we call this practical drift, but drift occurs throughout your organization. Don't think it's something that just happens at the work face. We have a geology, we have a company goals, we have leaders, we have procedures and systems, we've got work plans, equipment, want to maintain it, we work teams, and this wonderful system is kept focused with KPIs. And we've talked about the drift we get here, but we also get drift in work groups. We start off and we design work groups. Work groups will have so many people. Those people will have a certain level of competency and training, and we'll send them underground to do that. But this too drifts over time. People leave the company, new people come in, training falls behind. We'll end up with a competency that has drifted from what we originally assumed. The classic place this happens is in maintenance. Your equipment manufacturer could say, please service that particular device on your mobile plant every 3 months. But quickly, the workshop realized, every time we pull that apart every 3 months, it's fine. So we say, we can save a bit of money, let's do it every 6 months. That goes on for a couple of years, and they say, we've pulled it apart every 6 months and it's still fine, let's bump it out to a year. And then we get an incident, and the original equipment manufacturer says, my goodness, you should have been looking at that every 3 months. But we've drifted. And KPIs reward drift. By and large, the KPIs we have reward our employees and contractors to go faster, to adapt more, to move quickly. And then we only penalize them if there's a reportable injury. We're happy to see it going forward once it's injury-free, but there's a problem then when there's an injury. And what happens inside our organizations is we started here with safety first. Nobody really planned it, but we've ended up over here, where production really is first. All those adaptations, everything has made our system brittle. And what we mean by that is those controls we carefully designed at corporate or at the side office, which were written down on paper, suddenly aren't effective anymore because we've drifted to the point where they're ineffective. Because the work has been done in a different way, the risk has been managed in a different way throughout all levels in our organization. And what happens is, this brittleness, unless you're looking for it, is non-obvious. It just sits there waiting for what we would call an initiating event. And that's usually human error or bad luck. And it's only when that interacts with the system do we produce a situation where the brittleness of the system becomes evident and we get a serious accident or we get a fatality. A great way to think about this is Jenga, and I know many of you use Jenga in the room. If you're a manager and Jenga is your organization, that's what the view looks like. Look perfect. Good, solid structure. If you're working inside that organization, it looks like this. It's full of holes. All the holes Steve was talking about earlier in Piper Alpha. But unless you're looking for those holes, they can be hard to see. But those holes are our ineffective controls that we thought would be there when we need them. I'm going to show you an incident, and I'm going to summarize the findings of the investigation. Just prepare yourselves. Cause of failure. Block not removed with due skill and care. And we stop there. But of course, we know the real cause of this incident could have been the fact that that block was missing. Or maybe it was actually, this one here or that one there. Actually, it's probably a load of it happening together. Think back to our causal diagram of the bus driver fatality. How different is this? The initiating event there was the bus moving over to the other side of the road. That exposed the brittleness in the system that was meant to be there to protect people. And this is the fundamental difference between high reliability organizations and I would say the rest of us. The rest of us genuinely believe that we can build a perfect system to keep people safe, and as long as we can get them to comply with it, we won't have any incidents. And if we do have an incident, we just have to identify where they didn't comply with it and make an example of them. HROs know you can't design a perfect system. They know even if you could design a perfect system, it would drift on you tomorrow. So what HROs do differently to everyone else is they know you will drift, and they manage the drift. They don't police you back to the procedures that didn't work the first time. They adopt the procedures in a safe manner and build in more harder controls and more effective controls to keep their system strong. And this is a continuous process. Look at the name. The word reliability I don't find particularly helpful here. But you will notice the word safety isn't here at all. Word safety is not in the title, because safety is an outcome of reliability. And what we really mean by reliability here is predictability. HROs strive for their work to be undertaken predictably. When the people go out to do the work, it will happen in a predictable manner, not an unpredictable manner, because what happens if when we get unpredictability in our work? We adapt faster to deal with that unpredictability. Every pilot wants the most predictable flight you can imagine. And that's what they strive for. The only way you get predictable is by becoming a learning organization. And you'll hear this term a lot. And I really, you know, on some level don't care whether you learn because of high reliability organizations or you learn through HOP. It's the learning that matters. So HROs are great at going, I want to know where these holes are before the incident happens, so I can push a block back in there. I can strengthen my control so it's effective again. There's five ways high reliability organizations do it. The first thing they do is they look for warning signs. In other words, they assume, given the complexity of their operations, that they are going to fail, that their system is going to let them down. And then they actively seek to identify the warning signs for where that is before a bad thing happens. If you want to upset a high reliability organizational manager, give the report that tells them that all the critical controls are green. Because they know that's rubbish. And they want to dig deeper. They check and hunt for what is normal work. How do people actually do the work versus how do we think we do it? Because, of course, if that's different, the controls may be ineffective. They seek out the expertise inside their organization. One of the crazy things that happens when we build normal organizations, and what I mean by that is hierarchical organizations with bosses and all that sort of stuff, what we do is the expertise gets trapped in the wrong place in the organization. The expertise is not heard. The subject matter experts don't necessarily have the same power as other people. High reliability organizations work really, really hard on making sure the right people are in the right places inside their organization and at the right time and have a decision-making capability, particularly when things start going wrong. They're always asking what happens next. Yes, we have the controls, but if they fail, is someone going to die? Are we going to blow something up? What happens next? And are we willing to live with that? And they're always questioning why. You want to upset a manager in a HRO? Tell them the incident was caused by human error. They'll tell you no. Go back and tell me why the system failed to contain that error. Because that error should be expected. Why didn't the system do something to prevent the outcome? These have fancy names. Preoccupation with failure. It's also called chronic unease, which you may hear quite a lot of. Sensitivity to operations, deference to expertise, commitment to resilience, and a reluctance to simplify. Now, at this point, most people say, where can I buy the pack to apply this to my organization? But what these are is, these are five lenses. That's all they are. They're five lenses that you can shine on your existing system. And by using each of those lenses, you should be able to say, this part of our system, how we do this thing, this practice, is either consistent with a HRO principle or it's inconsistent. quick example. If you decide that you don't like SIF peas, we don't like having all these incidents happen that have potential to hurt our people. We need to reduce them. If you put a target on that, that will drive down the SIFP reporting, and that will be inconsistent with identifying the warning signs. You want to know the SIFPs because they are your single best source of information of where you nearly knocked over that Jenga tower. And you want to figure out which of the bricks you need to get in there fast to strengthen it back up again. In other words, which of your controls, particularly if they're critical controls, you need to get back in the system and have a look at because they're clearly not working. These five characteristics are a lens you shine in your existing system. Do not throw out your existing system. It's got you this far. Just understand that compliance won't get you any further. And we've seen this across every industry. Compliance will get you so far, so much more important than no system, but then you hit diminishing returns, and you hit diminishing returns because you cannot design a perfect system to keep people safe, and if you could, it would drift on you anywhere. So we're not talking about taking some leap and throwing compliance behind, particularly if you're in a very, very high hazard industry. Compliance will always be a major part of how you manage risk, but we are taking a leap to a learning culture. In simple terms, what that means is we're saying, yes, we have a system. Yes, we want people to comply with it. Yes, we'll check whether people comply with it. But now we'll ask a further question. If they comply with it, is it actually effective? Is it actually effective at keeping our people safe? Focus on your controls. That's what the Fatality Review has taught us. All you'll ever do with compliance is check the system is there, with the assumption being it will protect people. Once you start looking at effectiveness, and you have to engage with the front line to do that, you have to engage with your technical experts to do that, use all the tools you have to do that and learn, and you'll find suddenly you'll throw out a chunk of your compliance because you'll realize it's compliance for compliance sake, and it's cluttering everything, and focus on the compliance that makes you effective. And this comes with a warning if you go back and tell your boss this. Because what you're really saying, or what your boss will hear you saying, is you want me to listen to bad news all day? You want me to listen about where I've got holes in my system from morning to night? You want me to do that? And of course, the way we structure our companies and the way we reward people, we don't tell managers the bad news. We smother the holes in green. Beware of the green. All green ever does is hide the gaps in your Jenga tower. What HROs do is they understand a fundamental thing, and that is there's no such thing as bad news. Bad news is good news because bad news tells you where your system's weak. But boy, this is a hell of a journey for a board and a senior leadership team. Someone said to me recently, you need to understand, Sean, board members can't cope with a safety graph that goes up. You get this right, your safety graph, particularly on SIFPs, will go up. And finally, just to finish, if you're sitting here and you're wondering, how far along the path am I being to a high reliability in our organization? An organization that doesn't just put a system in place, but knows that system will drift and knows to check it for compliance and effectiveness. How far along that journey do I think I am? Then this is the question you need to answer for yourself. How well does bad news flow inside your organization? That will probably tell you everything you need to know about where you are right now on a journey from just compliance to and learning. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Sean. We don't have time for questions, but you're going to be around, right?
I'll be around, yeah. Please chase me down. I'll be here for the 4 days. So by all means, just any questions, any disagreements. I'm sure we'll have a few disagreements in the room, but love to talk to everyone. So definitely track me down.
Awesome. Thank you again, Sean, for that presentation.
Thank you, everyone.
So let's talk, because I got a lot of questions for you.
Yeah, go for it.
So should we talk a little bit about yesterday's session, or... or no, the one that you did in person.
Happy to, yeah.
So you changed some stuff up. I know yesterday you talked a lot about critical controls. Why was there not so heavy of a conversation today about that?
Because I think there's a lot of people who aren't over and across critical controls. I think that was one sort of even learning from yesterday.
Okay.
So I think that's one part of it. And really just trying to bring it back and focus it on the learning. Absolutely, critical controls is the place I think we need to go with this. The danger we have with critical controls is that people treat it as another compliance exercise. And then it just becomes another layer of audit across the top. What critical controls really do is they give us a focus on where we should be learning, where our organization is not as effective as it should be.
Okay. So when you start talking about critical controls, are you looking at more as tools or are you looking at different lenses as you're kind of going through the process? Like when you broke this down, when you said, okay, I'm going to talk about a presentation about this, particularly to, it was upper management yesterday. I hope I don't get too much over saying some of this stuff, but how were you looking at it when you were forming your presentation?
So I think there's a few things here. So out of the mining review, the key finding, there was training, there was supervision issues, but the key finding that was across almost all the fatalities was ineffective controls. Controls that the organization believed were in place, but were ineffective on the day. In other words, controls that look good on paper, but in reality didn't work. So that really started us along the path of you have to narrow this stuff down for particularly high hazard industries in terms of managing hazards. It really comes down to, it is not hazards that kill people, it's ineffective controls. So I think there's a lot of focus on the hazard and we have to shift that to the controls. Do the controls, are they there? Do they work? Are they effective? And that's the change we need. What we get with high reliability organization as a theory, or HOP as well, is you get a different way of thinking about those controls. You move beyond those controls as simply something that needs to be complied with, to saying, can we learn about control effectiveness? Will they work the way we need them to work? And there's just that long history of applying that sort of thinking to what is, you know, something that I think is new for a lot of people, which is critical controls, of saying, let's focus on the controls that will actually stop people dying. Okay. And let's pull them up out of the melee of stuff that sits there that people argue over.
So let me ask kind of a strange question, because normal organizations kind of go through that weird journey that it goes something like this. They start off with behavior-based safety.
Yep.
Then they hear about HOP.
Yep.
And then they go through the philosophy of HOP, because automatically you know that the assumption is, hold on, isn't this a new training program? Isn't this the way that everything's going to change? So when we go from behavior-based safety to HOP, and you start looking at HROs in particular,
yep,
are you looking at this as a different lens? Are you looking at this as a different philosophy? Or how, when you're going through this process, how are you looking at it?
Right. So I think there's a few things that all of them have in common. You know, and if we stay with HOP, which I probably know better than behavioral based, but you got HOP, you got high reliability organizations. Both of them are absolutely focused on learning and making sure that we just don't assume a system works, but understanding how that system works. Both of them understand that you can't take a solely top-down approach to that. You have to engage with the front line. You have to understand what the frontline workers are doing, how they're doing the work, how you're rewarding them, what they see as the hazards, what they see as the controls. That's a fundamental part to this process. Where high reliability organizations comes in is that in very high hazard industries, you have what I would class as sort of system hazards, hazards that are beyond the control of an individual, that the organization really has to grapple with and manage. So for example, if you're in a coal mine, you've got a methane gas ignition risk. No one individual can manage and control that risk. That has to be a system control. So high reliability organizational theory gives you a series of lenses to look at your system and say, is this part of my system consistent or inconsistent with high reliability organizational theory? If it is, you keep it. If it's not, you seriously think of getting rid of it, because it's probably distracting people from what's really important.
So how many people do you think are going to sit around and go, this is going to be HRO versus HOP? Because you know that these conversations are happening.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I genuinely don't think that is an argument that's a useful argument to have. I think
You know, both Hop and Hetero are trying to do the same thing. You know, we're dealing with companies where there's a system, and there seems to be a general belief inside companies that as long as you design a system and you get people to comply with that system, that then you will avoid incidents and fatalities. And Hop and Hetero are basically rejecting that premise. They're saying, no, you can't. It's too complex for you to design a perfect system. And even if you do, it'll drift tomorrow, and the controls you thought were effective won't be effective tomorrow. They could be ineffective. So they're both trying to do the same thing from that perspective. I think they tackle them in different ways. You know, Hop seems to start with a worker and move out. Hetero tends to start from the system and move in, of which the worker is a key part of that. I often get accused from some quarters of suggesting that, oh no, you just get the system right and you ignore the worker. That's not what I'm saying at all. The worker is a fundamental part of the system. And I think you just get this huge overlap between higher liability and Hop. And I think you end up using a lot of the same sort of tools. So when we're talking about higher liability organizations, for example, we end up in a situation where you want more warning signs of failure. Now, one of the ways you get more warning signs of failure is you get more hazard reports, or you get more incidents that have a high potential, didn't cause a problem, but have a high potential for a fatality or a serious incident, the so-called, you know, SIFPs. And we all want to know, if we're Hop or HRO, you know, what do we learn from that? That's what we're trying to do here. And it's really about saying, you know, what systems are you using? And one of the observations we have is that, you know, companies like big, you know, investigation techniques like ICAM. But if you have a wall of good quality PSIFs coming through the door that have the potential to tell you, you know, so much about where your vulnerabilities are in your system, you're going to flood the investigation system really quickly. So what we say is use things like learning teams. Just get, you know, use the same tools as Hop because they work. But do use different techniques for different things. You know, you may have PSIFs or SIFPs which only identify, ooh, nothing bad happened, but we had a critical control and it was ineffective. Now, do you really need to do too much investigation there, or do you just log the finding that this was ineffective and you do something about it? Because that allows you to find trends. But as you move up through more complex incidents, you have to use more complex techniques and use the techniques that are right for the job and make sure you don't stop at human error, that you push beyond that to do all the things that Hop says and all the things that HRO say, which is understand what was driving that person to do that, what was rewarding the person for doing that. Understand those things. Don't just blame the individual.
So how do you prepare a company based on what you were saying slide-wise on being willing to accept bad news?
Oh, it's really hard. So you have to start at the top. So this is
going into the board level. This is where the conversation starts.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to go in and because you're asking them to accept something quite disturbing. You're asking to accept, you know, this system that helps you sleep at night. Well, guess what? It's not perfect. And your job is to hunt out the warning signs for where it's not perfect and do something about it. Now, that's a pretty confronting proposition for any organization. And what also complicates things is that many organizations, particularly big high hazard ones, have made a move to be to have a compliance culture. They've put in their systems and procedures, and that has dramatically improved things, you know, much better than a reactive culture where that's not happening. But often what happens is the amount of blood, sweat, and tears involved in hammering that system into place on your workforce. For many managers, it is almost inconceivable that you would now turn around and say to the frontline worker, hey, I genuinely want you to tell me where the system I forced upon you doesn't work, and then I'm willingly going to go and address those issues. That's quite a grown-up conversation that we're discovering many organizations are not quite willing to take. But that is the beginning of it. And unless your senior leaders are bought into the idea that they're going to get more bad news, and that's actually good news because it's telling them where their system is weak, particularly where their controls are weak or ineffective. In that case, once they get their head around that, that becomes very powerful. But it's an incredible shift, particularly when so much of what we do is about driving incident metrics downwards. people still want to drive incidents that have a high potential downwards, even though they're what we're going to learn from.
So here's what we're going to do, because I know that you've had a long day, so I'm not going to keep you too long. And I know that we're going to do this again before it's all said and done. So if people want to find out more information about you and what your organization's doing, where can they go?
A few places, website, bradyhewitt.com.au. You'll find a lot of resources on there. We write a lot of articles. I would probably point you to some podcasts that are there. We've done one, which is based on the Fatality Review, called Rethinking Safety, and it explores a lot of the concepts we've talked about today. It was interviews with the industry, with the regulator, with safety experts, with the unions. The other one is the Brady Haywood podcast, where we talk a lot about famous failures. But what we do is we dig into the organizational causes of those failures to see how, you know, those failures really don't happen because of frontline decisions. Those failures happen because of systemic decisions that were, you know, made in many cases many years before, that frontline workers have to deal with and try and manage, and are sometimes unsuccessful in managing them. So between both of those, you get a good flavor for what things look like when they go wrong and what the preventative side of things looks like as well.
All right, well, Sean, I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
The views and opinions expressed during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Safety FM and or Radio Big. The content discussed, including examples of analysis, is provided for illustrative purposes only. It should not be applied as the sole solution in real-world scenarios, as it is based on limited and dated open source information. Any assumptions made during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are not reflective of Safety FM and or Radio Big. No portion of this broadcast, podcast, or radio show may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of Safety FM and or Radio Big. For permission requests, please contact Safety FM or Radio Big directly.